Welcome again to the Denmark Street Deep Dive, a podcast intended to feed your enthusiasm for the world of Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, creations of the fabulous J.K. Rowling, writing as Robert Galbraith. This time we are following The Career of Evil, the third of the successful crime fiction books, which has also been adapted into an equally well-received television series starring Tom Burke as Strike and Holiday Granger as Robin. I'm going to be delving into the plot, themes, prose and characters, and here's the usual pre-warning, spoilers ahead. I'm giving away everything about Career of Evil here and will reference other books. I give spoiler warnings because I think the books are best appreciated without knowing what's coming next. But the point of the deep dive is to highlight facets of the book you may not have noticed, because one of the pleasures of the Strike books is the rereadability. And if I can encourage you to do that, so much the better.
Coffee.
Oh, yes, please, I feel awful.
That's because you drank every bottle of wine in London.
Career of Evil marks quite a shift in the books. Whereas Strike has had only oblique or no connection at all to the suspects in the previous two cases, this story takes a very personal turn as a severed leg is sent to the agency, addressed to Robin. Quite apart from the obvious significance of sending an amputee an amputated leg, the limb comes with a cryptic quote alluding to Strike's long-dead mother, Leda, and it leads Strike down a painful path of recollecting three men, all of whom have reason to bear a grudge against him. And the leg being addressed to Robin means that she is no longer a character in the supporting cast of Strike's story, which is initially where the balance of the first two books sit. She has stepped centre stage alongside Strike himself. We learn much more about the pasts of both Robin and Strike as the case progresses, mostly via their interaction with the suspects, Donald Lang and Noel Brockbank, both men Strike investigated when he was SIB, one successfully convicted, the other not, and, even more personally, Jeff Whittaker, the man Strike firmly believes killed his mother, but was acquitted. There's an important style shift too. Whereas the other books have been mostly written in the third person with insight mainly into the thoughts of Strike and Robin, only occasionally dipping into the thoughts of others like Matthew, Career of Evil is punctuated with a series of disturbing interludes, marked out as the only chapters with titles rather than song lyric epigraphs, where we read the twisted, hate-filled perspective of the killer. We don't learn who he is until quite late in the book, but these chapters serve to increase the sense of prowling menace in the case, highlight important aspects of the killer's psyche that tie into broader themes in the book, and, for those playing whodunit, sprinkle legitimate clues and red herrings along the way. In the adaptation, the menacing tension is instead created by a slight alteration of the plot, where Strike becomes a credible suspect for the murder himself, using staged photos and other devices to show that the killer was a cunning and devious planner. The case takes us further afield than before, with Strike visiting Scotland and he and Robin embarking on a memorable road trip to Barrow, where we see an amping up of a, so far, merely hinted at tension between them, but more of that later. Rowling's writing in this book is as full of insightful flourishes as ever, and one passage in particular demonstrates a number of things. I'll read the extract. Nobody who had not lived there would ever understand that London was a country unto itself. They might resent it for the fact that it held more power and money than any other British city, but they could not understand that poverty carried its own flavour there, where everything cost more, where the relentless distinctions between those who had succeeded and those who had not were constantly painfully visible. The distance between Ellen's vanilla-columned flat in Clarence Terrace and the filthy Whitechapel squat where his mother had died could not be measured in mere miles. They were separated by infinite disparities, by the lotteries of birth and chance, by faults of judgment and lucky breaks. His mother and Ellen, both beautiful women, both intelligent, one sucked down into a morass of drugs and human filth, the other sitting high over Regent's Park behind spotless glass. Robin, too, was thinking about London. It had Matthew in its spell, but he had no interest in the labyrinthine world she probed daily during her detective work. He looked excitedly towards the surface glitter, the best restaurants, the best areas to live, as though London were a huge monopoly board. He had always had a divided allegiance to Yorkshire, to their hometown Masson. His father was Yorkshire-born, while his late mother had come from Surrey and had carried with her an air of having gone north on sufferance. She had persistently corrected any Yorkshire turns of speech in Matthew and his sister Kimberly. His carefully neutral accent had been one of the reasons that Robin's brothers had not been impressed when they had started dating. In spite of her protestations, in spite of his Yorkshire name, they had sensed the wannabe southerner. Rowling is employing her highly effective skill at creating a sense of place here in Strike's thoughts, giving insight into a London that isn't immediately apparent, casually lobbing in a reference to the way the rest of the UK views the capital city. It's social commentary intertwined with a literary invocation of place, but as the corresponding dip into Robin's thoughts unfurls, it's more than even that. It's tying the setting and the characters into the themes of the book, of false fronts and misogyny. And it's to this we turn next.
The leg, the Blue Oyster Cult lyrics, that's someone going to a lot of effort to get inside my head.
Okay, final warning that I'm giving away the killer. The title Career of Evil is, like the other titles in the series, not simply an eye-catching and appropriate title in the crime fiction genre, but an allusion to the content of the book. Strike himself can be said to have had a career of evil, albeit on the side of the angels. The three main suspects are men who have spent their lives perpetrating evil, soaked in misogyny. They've invested enormous effort into it, putting up false fronts to better enable them to continue. Noel Brockbank is a paedophile whom Strike encountered when Brockbank's daughter, Brittany, disclosed that he was raping her. A volatile, brutal and manipulative man, he attacks Strike with a bottle during his arrest, and Strike reacts with his boxer's instincts and undeniable animosity towards a child rapist. Strike's actions exacerbate a pre-existing rugby injury Brockbank had sustained, and eventually Brockbank faces no charges, is invalided out with an army pension, epilepsy and a grudge against Strike, and is also free to continue his abuse of his daughter and others. Noel is adept at grooming, a key factor in paedophilia, and it's no coincidence that he meets his girlfriend Alyssa and her daughters, so pivotal to the plot, in a church. During the search for Brockbank's whereabouts, Strike and Robin visit Market Harborough, where the parish church of St. Dionysius is adorned with a quote from 1 Samuel 16, verse 7, "Man looketh upon the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart." There are important clues here both to the crime investigation and the more personal, emotional elements for the two characters, but I don't want to get ahead of myself here. Christianity is replete with references to not putting weight on outward appearances, and in Brockbank we see the exact reason safeguarding policies exist. A sad, plausible story of woe and a veneer of kindness, all with the design of getting access to victims. Strike even slyly references the way religion can be a cover for bad actions when he asks D.I. Wardle if he's Catholic, after Wardle makes a naive assumption about the possibility. But as far as whitewashed tombs concealing dead bones go, no one fits that quite as well as Donald Lang, the cunning sociopath whose savagery Strike first encounters in the boxing ring, and then later when he discovers Lang's abused wife Rona, physically constrained and bleeding with their doomed baby son, and who is indeed our serial killer. Lang's misogyny is laid bare in the chapters written from his perspective, jarringly using the pronoun it for the woman with whom he lives. This is, from the perspective of constructing a mystery, a useful device to conceal that Lang is masquerading as Ray Williams, and that it is in fact Hazel, the older sister of the victim Kelsey Platt, whose leg Robin receives at the start of the book. The denouement would have much less impact had we known Lang was the killer from Chapter 7 when it is first mentioned. The first-person perspective is, of course, only the writer's way of concealing Lang's identity. He himself uses many false fronts to aid his evil intent, from disguising his identity to stalking Robin using the very surveillance skills she herself uses. Even his grisly gift of the leg contains a note with Blue Oyster Cult lyrics, which is a concealing misdirection that sends Strike hurtling down the wrong trail after the third suspect, Jeff Whittaker, the man who married his mother and, Strike believes, killed her. On first glance, Whittaker might seem to buck the trend of concealment, given that he is openly amoral and evil and never changes, even making it part of his persona. But he gets away with much precisely because it is assumed to be a persona. He continues to attract women despite his behaviour and reputation, something which Strike reflects on with bafflement a few times in the book. This has a lot to do with certain romantic fiction tropes of women softening and saving bad men. And incidentally, it's not a trope Rowling is employing with Strike and Robin. But I really mustn't go there yet. You can tell I really want to, though, can't you? But this is the trick with Whittaker. Whereas Lang and Brockbank feign the appearance of goodness, Whittaker relies upon a society that assumes a truly bad man wouldn't be so obvious. And society's assumptions, the clichés that are so readily accepted without examining them too closely, aid all of the suspects in one way and another. Aside from Whittaker's acquittal of Leader Strike's murder, because the court readily accepted the narrative of a troubled woman consumed by drugs, Brockbank finds access to children through attending a church run by a priest primed to be impressed by the story of a man fighting personal demons and seeking redemption. And Lang is aided and abetted in his utter hatred of women by the misogyny in wider culture. We see this echoed through the events and settings of the book, from Strike's visits to witnesses in strip clubs, the seedy client from the agency continually seeking evidence of infidelity from his romantic partners because he has a strange kink for it, to the response of the press to Lang's victims, depending on their disparate backgrounds and their perceived deserving or undeserving status. When Lang brutally attacks Lila Monckton, who is working as a prostitute, it barely creates a ripple, effortlessly overshadowed by the royal wedding. We learn through the first-person chapters that Lang has already killed a prostitute, Martina Rossi, but the murders of prostitutes rarely make headlines. It's a hugely dangerous way to make money, and all the moral negativity is directed towards the women who sell sex, rather than the shadowy male figures who purchase women's bodies. It's only when Heather Smart, a woman with a respectable job, is added to the roster of victims like the innocent schoolgirl, Kelsey Platt, that the prostituted women are registered as important enough to be added to the list of sordid crimes committed by the Shacklewell Ripper.
Men like Lang and Brockbank and Whittaker, women are things to be used. She still misses it.
I couldn't look at the notions of false fronts and misogyny without turning my attention to Matthew Cunliffe, Robin's long-term boyfriend, sometime fiancé, and, as of the last line in the book, husband. Attentive readers and series watchers will be unlikely to view Matt with much warmth, but his true character comes into sharp focus in Career of Evil. We've already mentioned a section in which his attraction to London is characterised as surface glitter and his pretensions as a wannabe southerner. This is mostly how we learn about Matt in the book. We read about his behaviour as Robin recalls or experiences it, and through Strike's perceptive realisations as he and Robin grow closer and share more personal information with each other, most notably her reason for leaving uni, the rape and attempted murder she endured. Matt's insecurities seem to be based in his jealousy over Strike, but this is only part of the story. Keir Logan, who plays Matt in the adaptation, understands the character well and is definitely not his greatest fan. He describes him as a man who feels threatened by Robin, quote, wanting to strive higher, and he expresses that by claiming to protect her, saying she shouldn't put herself in danger, close quote. Keir has nailed something about Matt here. His false front of concern for Robin is actually based in resentment about her ever achieving something. His jealousy over Strike, it increasingly becomes clear, is a proxy for his need to feel he is better than Robin. At one point, the perceptive Strike realises that Robin's defensive reaction to some good-natured teasing on his part arises because she is used to having Matt belittle her achievements. Robin herself inadvertently acknowledges this when she's thinking about the shoes she chose to buy for the wedding, when she chose a pair without platforms. The key line here is, "The truth was that Matthew did not like her too tall." She has her place, and Matt wants to keep her there, below him. You might think a good-looking, athletic young man would feel more confident in himself, but as I've said before, Rowling is fond of using handsome as a less than positive description of someone. The very best example of this in Career of Evil is at the end of chapter 57, when we follow Matt's manipulative machinations as he flirts with the barista while Robin is otherwise engaged, and then not only cuts a call from Strike, but tricks Robin into telling him her phone passcode so he can delete Strike's answer phone message and block his number. I'll read the pertinent paragraphs. Once safe inside the men's bathroom, he opened up her phone. Getting rid of any record of Strike's calls meant deleting her entire call history. This he did. Then he called voicemail, listened to Strike's recorded message, and deleted that too. Finally, he went into the settings on Robin's phone and blocked Strike. Breathing deeply, he turned to his handsome reflection in the mirror. Strike had said on the voicemail message that if he did not hear back from her, he would not call again. The wedding was in 48 hours' time, and the anxious, defiant Matthew was counting on Strike keeping his word. Rowling makes a point of him noticing his handsome reflection after describing his deceptions in some detail. Notice also that he doesn't seem to realise that his unscrupulous plan relies for success on a more honourable man keeping his word. Unfortunately for him, Strike only said he wouldn't call again. He said nothing about not coming to the wedding.
We'll call it a wedding cancellation present.
Robin's journey in this story is huge, and Career of Evil is, as I've mentioned, arguably the book where the balance shifts between Strike and Robin. This is emphatically not just Strike's story anymore. Robin Ellicott has stepped out of the supporting cast and into equal billing. We learn more about her past, her family, her motivations and her desires. We begin to see what makes her tick, how she is treated by her family and how she responds. One of the most powerful parts of the narrative is her desperate determination to hold on to what was stolen from her in a stairwell by a masked man, her hopes of becoming a detective. The masked man who raped her is another very obvious and simple manifestation of a false front, of course. Her connection to Strike, more of that later, I'm getting there, I promise, is in part so powerful because he represents her liberation from the stifling of her whole self by Matt and her family and indeed by the rest of society. Which is why she reacts as she does when Strike begins to do it too, and why she shrinks down into submission when he sacks her. Some of the stifling attempts are well meant. Linda, Robin's mother, is motivated by concern for her daughter, and in the book at least, is trying valiantly to hold a middle ground between Robin's choice of either independence or forgiving and marrying Matt. In the adaptation, she's a little more clearly pulling for Robin to buy the fancy shoes and marry the philandering git, but we've already established what a nasty piece of work Matt is, so I won't labour the point. Strike is only too aware of the dangers posed to a woman in a world full of misogyny, aided by the reality of men being, generally, stronger and more violent than them. As it happens, Strike is entirely right to act to disrupt Robin's regular movements, frustrating though she finds this, because it does throw Lang off her trail. Robin's rescue of Alyssa's daughter, Angel, causes a painful rift between them, and objectively, it's a foolhardy move on her part. But it's also very in character, and though Strike's fury about it is understandable and even reasonable, it also shows another way in which he and Robin are two peas in a pod. He punched Brockbank, the man Robin is attempting to rescue Angel from, in large part in response to the man's perverted behaviour, which meant that justice was not served for Brittany, and Strike is plagued with guilt from it. Robin acted in a similarly impulsive and reckless manner, with similar possible repercussions. Having said that, it's worth mentioning that her actions broke the deadlock in the case and forced Strike to act decisively to stop Lang for good. And it's also noteworthy that when Strike first discovered the extent of Lang's depravity when he rescued Rona Lang, he wasn't following the rules of engagement properly himself either. His angry reaction is one of the most painful bits of the book to read for those who have been enjoying the growing closeness of the two detectives. But I suggest that even his fury underlines his attachment to Robin, because she put herself in harm's way, but his desire to protect her isn't about just her physical safety. His guilt over his actions leading to a paedophile going free is shown to torment him throughout the book. The very last thing he wants is Robin's psyche loaded up with guilt for doing the same. Which brings me to the very much more pleasurable parts of Career of Evil, Robin and Strike's relationship. Finally, I hear you cry.
Never doubted you.
The first two books give us the genesis of, and with hindsight, plenty of Easter eggs that hint at what is to come. But Career of Evil seems to be when Rowling decides to take the training wheels off and let the fledgling Strelicott relationship chemistry begin freewheeling down a bloody long hill. From that perspective, despite the deeply unpleasant subject matter, the book is an absolute delight. After a start in which their interactions are as brightly professional as they have been in the previous two books, in chapter 6 we start to get an inkling that these are two people who get on very well indeed, with what I think is the first instance we see of properly comfortable banter between them, as they discuss over the phone the letters kept in the nutter drawer while Robin walks around the supermarket after work. I'll have a bash at the extract.
Are you all right?
Yes, of course.
Where are you?
Waitrose. A short, balding man was perusing the shelf of sherry just behind Robin, his eyes level with her breasts. When she moved aside, he moved with her. Robin glared. He blushed and moved away.
Well, you should be okay in Waitrose.
Said Robin, her eyes on the bald man's retreating back. Listen, this might be nothing, but I've just remembered we've had a couple of weird letters in the last few months.
Nutter letters?
Don't start. Robin always protested at this blanket term. They had attracted a significant increase in oddball correspondence since Strike had solved his second high-profile murder case. The most coherent of the letters simply asked for money, on the assumption that Strike was now immensely rich. Then came those who had strange personal grudges that they wished Strike to avenge, those whose waking hours seemed devoted to proving outlandish theories, those whose needs and wishes were so inchoate and rambling that the only message they conveyed was mental illness, and finally, now these seem nutty, Robin had said, a sprinkling of people, both male and female, who seemed to find Strike attractive.
Addressed to you? Strike asked, suddenly serious.
No, you. She could hear him moving about in his flat as they talked. Perhaps he was going out with Ellen tonight. He never talked about the relationship. If Ellen had not dropped by the office one day, Robin doubted that she would have known that she existed. Perhaps not until he turned up for work one day wearing a wedding ring.
What did they say? Asked Strike.
Well, one of them was from a girl who wanted to cut off her own leg. She was asking for advice. Say that again. She wanted to cut off her own leg, Robin enunciated clearly, and a woman choosing a bottle of rosé nearby threw her a startled look.
Jesus Christ, muttered Strike. And I'm not allowed to call them natters.
You think she managed it and thought I'd like to know?
Well, I thought a letter like that might be relevant, said Robin repressively.
Some people do want to cut bits of themselves off. It's a recognised phenomenon. It's called not being a nutter, she added, correctly anticipating him, and he laughed. And there was another one from a person who signed with their initials, a long letter. They went on and on about your leg and how they wanted to make it up to you.
Well, if they were trying to make it up to me, you'd think they would have sent a man's leg. I'd look pretty bloody stupid.
Don't, she said. Don't choke. I don't know how you can.
I don't know how you can't, he said, but kindly.
She heard a very familiar scraping noise, followed by a sonorous clang.
You're looking in the nutter drawer. I don't think you should call it the nutter drawer, Robin. Bit disrespectful to our mentally ill.
I'll see you tomorrow, she said, smiling against her will, and hung up on his laughter.
It's a genuinely funny exchange, one of the many they share in the book, and it reveals a mutual sense of humour and level of ease with each other that only increases through the events of the books. Notice she'd already been teasing him about the fan letters from people who found him attractive. The discovery of Matt's infidelity and her subsequent revealing to Strike of painful past events provide a neat parallel to scenes way back in The Cuckoo's Calling when Strike was in a similar position, and this forms a parallel Kairos moment for them too. Kairos is a term from the art of rhetoric and has its roots as a technical archery term. It refers to that perfect moment when everything aligns and the truth is revealed. One of the quirks of archery is that it's not just a question of pointing at the target and letting the arrow fly. You have to take in the variables and pick your moment. And after 5 books now of 2 people on a path of growth and healing, Rowling is clearly in no hurry to hit the target yet. But she's clearly taking aim. In contrast to Robin's strained and unhealthy relationship with Matt and his constant undermining of her, Strike and Robin are both discovering that laying down false fronts and revealing the truth about themselves leads to levels of trust that neither of them have experienced in a relationship before. Going back briefly to that quote from 1 Samuel on the church in Market Harborough, they are each beginning to look beyond the outward appearance and reveal their hearts. That's not to say that neither of them have any false fronts in this book. Robin, despite learning about Matt's infidelity and being conscious of his endless attempts to coerce her compliance, decides to marry him anyway, consciously choosing a pretense because she thinks her hopes are lost. Strike too, in his relationship with Ellen, is simply going through the motions. It's subtle at first because she's going through a divorce and has her own reasons for maintaining certain appearances, but eventually, the man who has a self-acknowledged healthy libido is pushing himself through sexual encounters with no relish whatsoever. Strike's libido makes an entertaining appearance during their road trip on the trail of suspects, when he is standing in a private room in a massage parlour, taking in the trappings of sensual oils and slippery bodies, and his thoughts, for no reason he can think of, jump to Robin, who is sitting outside. This becomes very much a running joke as the series progresses. Both Strike and Robin inexplicably feel things when they think of each other, or receive calls or texts from each other, or are in each other's presence. They put these feelings down to chocolate or caffeine or general good news. In one scene in The Silkworm, Strike even thinks Robin is beautiful, but puts it down to having just been reading The Horrors of Bombyx Maury. Oh, honestly. You two. But obviously, this false front of denying themselves how they feel about each other and refusing to name it is eventually going to fall away because it's not just a lustful fancy. Strike is an honourable, decent man. Robin is a compassionate, determined woman. Their fondness for each other goes much deeper than simply fancying each other. And actually, I suspect Robin hasn't even got as far as clocking that that's part of how she feels about Strike. But that is definitely something I shall delve into another time. In one scene, towards the end of the book, Strike speaks to her on the phone and finds relief and solace in doing so. He's sharing the story of his altercation with Whittaker and how he helped Stephanie, but she stayed with the odious creep. I'll read the final extract for this episode.
As knights errant go, I was on the crap side. She fell over with him and cracked her head on the pavement. What I don't get, he added, after a short pause for reflection, is her. That was her chance. She could have left. I'd have got her to a refuge. I'd have seen her right. Why the fuck did she go back to him? Why do women do that?
In the fractional hesitation before Robin replied, Strike realised that a certain personal interpretation could be put on those words. I suppose, began Robin, and simultaneously Strike said, I didn't mean... Both stopped.
Sorry.
Go on, said Strike. I was only going to say that abused people cling to their abusers, don't they? They've been brainwashed to believe there's no alternative.
I was the bloody alternative, standing there, right in front of her.
The tantalising ambiguity here of exactly which woman Strike is referring to is, of course, echoed at the close of the novel, when Strike turns up, battered and bloodied, as Robin is saying her vows in a church, and even though she's next to Matthew, her I do is uttered while she's looking at Strike, standing at the back of the church. His plaintive inner cry of being the alternative standing right in front of her resonates clearly. As false fronts go, saying vows ostensibly to one man who doesn't deserve them, while looking delightedly at the man who does, takes some beating.
What will Matthew think?
Matthew can shove his thoughts up his own arse.
And there we have it for today. The longest and most in-depth episode yet, which was always going to happen, given the way Rowling stuffs her books with more and more goodies as she goes. Next time, you'll be unsurprised to know, I'm looking at book number 4, Lethal White. My thanks, as ever, to my fellow Strike obsessives and Strelicott shippers. And if you want to find me to share your thoughts, I'm on Twitter at Clara Strike. I'm off to take the Land Rover on a road trip. Anyone need a lift?
You offering me a piggyback?